This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
I'm walking through a well-manicured English country garden, and I'm out on a literary pursuit. I want to uncover how our most famous and well-loved books were written. I want to find out the story behind the story. What was happening at the time in the life of the author? And how did that influence the writing? I'm treading in the footsteps of the author I'm pursuing today. She often walked here, and if I tell you that I'm in the county of Hampshire, that may well give you a clue as to who she is. I'm in a very elegant dining parlour in a beautiful old house. And over here, by the window, is possibly the very desk where the author wrote the book I'm exploring today. The writer is, of course, Jane Austen, and the novel is Persuasion. Persuasion's heroine is Anne Elliot. At the start of the book, she's 27 years old and still a spinster. We find out that she lost her only chance at happiness 8 years earlier. She'd fallen madly in love with a young man called Frederick Wentworth, but her godmother, Lady Russell, persuades her to forsake him because he's penniless. But now, as the novel begins, a rich and still single Captain Frederick Wentworth suddenly reappears in Anne's life, stirring up emotions long buried but not forgotten.
A thousand feelings rushed on Anne, of which this was the most consoling, that it would soon be over. And it was soon over. Her eye half met Captain Wentworth's. A bow, a curtsy passed, she heard his voice. He talked to Mary, said all that was right. The room seemed full, but a few minutes ended it. It is over. It is over, she repeated to herself again and again in nervous gratitude. The worst is over.
Persuasion is Austen's last completed novel. She died in July 1817, and the novel was published posthumously at the end of December that same year. Why, if it was complete, was it only published after Austen died? The most obvious answer is that she finished it only just before her death. So is there evidence of when it was actually written? I'm going to see Catherine Sutherland, professor at St Anne's College in Oxford, to find out.
That's quite a challenge. There is no manuscript evidence for the famous six novels that were published in her lifetime or immediately afterwards. There are no manuscripts because at this stage, and remember she's writing in the very early part of the 19th century, manuscripts were not valued as artifacts themselves. They had no material value in them. Once they're in print, they're waste paper. But there is one exception to this, and that is two draft chapters, the very last two chapters from the manuscript of Persuasion.
So is Persuasion the only novel she finished in her lifetime that was published that we have manuscript remains for?
Yes.
That's fascinating.
That's right.
So I've come to the British Library, I've been admitted into its secret depths, and I'm hoping that I will find Catherine Sutherland here and we're going to have a chance to actually look at the manuscript of Persuasion. So, wow, yes, I'm looking at the moment at chapter 10 of Persuasion, which it's dated, isn't it?
Yes,
in the top
July
corner.
The 8th, 1816.
Yeah. Do we know when she thought it was finished? Do we have any evidence that she was like, yep, yeah, I'm done, that's it?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the manuscript itself says finished twice,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, very emphatic.
And of course we know it wasn't, because the printed ending is different, and we do not have the manuscript trace for that.
That's crucial. We have the original draft of the final two chapters, and it's dated, finished July 1816. But this ending in the manuscript isn't the ending that was printed. So it wasn't finished in July 1816. Are the differences between the endings so dramatic that the rewriting took Austin another year?
What's different is that her original ending, she set in a very different location. She has Captain Wentworth, the hero, and Anne Elliot meeting in Admiral Croft's lodgings.
In the manuscript ending, Wentworth has heard that Anne is going to marry Sir Walter Elliot. She tells him that she's not going to, and the floodgate is open for them to declare their love.
She turned her eyes towards him for the first time since re-entering the room. "No truth in any such report," he repeated. "No truth in any part of it." None. He had been standing by a chair, enjoying the relief of leaning on it. He now sat down, drew it a little nearer to her. It was a silent but very powerful dialogue. Still, a little nearer, and a hand taken and pressed, and Anne, my own dear Anne, bursting forth in the fullness of exquisite feeling. They were reunited. They were restored to all that had been lost.
This is the July 1816 ending, and to be honest, it's not that good. Austin's making a basic creative writing error of describing rather than showing what happens. But this all changes in the actual ending, which is full of drama. Anne and Wentworth have been together in company. She thinks he's writing a business letter. He leaves to deliver it, but then he comes back.
She only had time, however, to move closer to the table where he had been writing, when footsteps were heard returning. The door opened. It was himself. He begged their pardon, but he had forgotten his gloves, and instantly crossing the room to the writing table, and standing with his back to Mrs. Musgrove, he drew out a letter from under the scattered paper, placed it before Anne with eyes of glowing entreaty fixed on her for a moment, and hastily collecting his gloves was again out of the room. The work of an instant. Sinking into the chair which he had occupied, her eyes devoured the following words. "I can no longer listen in silence. You pierce my soul. I am half agony, half hope. Tell me not that I am too late. Dare not say that man forgets sooner than woman. I have loved none but you."
But we don't know when or how long it took her to make those final
revisions. Cassandra, her sister, says that she didn't finish it until sometime in August. So she was obviously using the next few weeks to write this different ending.
So it only took her another few weeks to get the ending right. It was finished in August 1816. That's almost a year before Austin died. So why wasn't it published while she was still alive? The manuscript can't tell us anything else, but do her letters from that last year give us any clues? Well, interestingly, she does mention persuasion in a letter she writes to her niece Fanny on the 13th of March, 1817.
"I have something ready for publication, which may, perhaps, appear about 12 months hence. This is for you alone."
OK, so the delay wasn't accidental. Clearly, Austin had a plan. When she's writing this letter to Fanny, the ending's been perfect for 8 months. But she doesn't think the novel's going to come out for another 12 months. Why is she waiting? She didn't know, of course, that she'd be dead by then. Or did she? Novelist Margaret Drabble.
Persuasion does have a dying fall. Persuasion, to me...
You think she knew?
She was ill when she wrote it. All the evidence is that she was quite seriously ill when she was writing Persuasion. She must have known she was dying. She was not getting better. My theory is that she did feel that she was unwell, and she wanted to have a novel with a happy ending for somebody who almost lost everything.
So is Austen writing a happy ending for herself, as well as for her heroine, Anne Elliot? If Persuasion's a deeply personal novel, and Austen knew she was dying, maybe she was holding it back because she wanted it published posthumously. I need to find out how closely Anne's story parallels Austen's life. Catherine Sutherland again.
The huge difference with Anne Elliot is that she's older. She's 27.
Yes, of course.
She has been in love and she's lost that love, and 8 years have gone by. So there's a sense in which the novel is almost its own sequel.
As in it's a sequel to the younger love stories
That's
of the
right.
other novels.
And in that sense, it's a different kind of novel because it's not a novel about a woman coming of age through finding love and finding out about herself. This is a heroine who has found love, lost it, and does understand herself and is to some extent defined by that love.
So do you think the more advanced age of Anne is to do with the fact that Jane Austen herself was older in years?
I don't think we need to see it like that. I think she's interested in time and time passing. That seems to be what the novel's about. And it starts off with a relationship already established between a hero and a heroine. And that's also interesting, I think, for making Anne a different kind of heroine, because she and Captain Wentworth share a secret. So there they are. They're already intimately linked, and it's quite an erotic link from the start, that they both know of this emotion that trembles between them when they're in a room together. And that's not like any other Jane Austen novel. And the only other person who is aware of it is the reader. So we're in an intense threesome.
Oh, we're in a ménage à trois.
We're in an intense threesome throughout the novel.
What is it about Persuasion? I'm fascinated by this idea of it being an erotic novel. How is that eroticism conveyed in the text? How is she, what's she doing there in the language or the plot that's eliciting that kind of response that something like Emma doesn't?
I think Anne is known to us and we know the world through Anne. We are inside her.
So it's about narrative perspective.
It's about narrative perspective, and it is an intense psychic drama. There's that wonderful scene in one of the early chapters where Anne is meeting Captain Wentworth. I think they're in the room together for the second time. Anne is bending down, nursing her small nephew.
Yes.
And the other nephew clambers onto her back. And the way that is described, as Captain Wentworth, he realises she's in difficulties and this small child just won't, he's pestering her, he won't get off the back. So Captain Wentworth comes over and he carefully removes the child from her back. But the way it's described through Anne,
"Walter," said she, "get down this moment. You are extremely troublesome. I am very angry with you." But not a bit did Walter stir. In another moment, however, she found herself being released from him. Someone was taking him from her, though he had bent down her head so much that his little sturdy hands were unfastened from around her neck, and he was resolutely borne away, before she knew that Captain Wentworth had done it. Her sensations on the discovery made her speechless. She could not even thank him. His kindness in stepping forward to her relief, the manner, the silence in which it had passed, she could not stay.
Persuasion is an intimate, even an erotic novel. If that eroticism is in any way based on Austen's life, then I can understand why she might not want the novel made public until after her death. So does Austen's love life hold any secrets that feed into Persuasion? To find out, I'm going to see Paula Byrne, author of The Real Jane Austen.
I definitely think her great love affair was not with the man she met in Sidmouth, but with the sea.
Well, hold on. So when did this happen and who did she meet?
The story goes like this. Every year in those Bath years, 1801 to 1805, roughly 1806, They would take these summers and they'd go round Devon and Dorset. And the story goes that she met somebody in Sidmouth in 1803, I think it was, and fell in love with him. This is Cassandra's story. And Cassandra thought this was the only man worthy of his sister. He fell in love, he asked if he could write to her, and then he died. So we don't know very much about this abortive romance and what really happened.
How intriguing. We've got hearsay evidence that there was a lost love in Austin's own life, a mysterious unnamed man in Sidmouth who tragically dies. But did Austin have any other lost romances? Well, on the 9th of January 1796, 20-year-old Austin writes to her sister Cassandra about a man.
I am almost afraid to tell you how my Irish friend and I behaved. Imagine to yourself everything most profligate and shocking in the way of dancing and sitting down together. He is a very gentlemanlike, good-looking, pleasant young man, I assure you.
But only a week later, things seem to have come to an end. On Friday the 17th of January, she writes to Cassandra again.
At length the day is come on which I am to flirt my last with Tom Lefroy, and when you receive this it will be over. My tears flow as I write at the melancholy idea.
Who was Tom Lefroy, and what happened?
The flirtation with Tom Lefroy is well documented. He was this Irish guy who was... Now, this is really interesting for Persuasion, because Tom Lefroy's aunt was a woman called Anna, Mrs. Lefroy. So Anne Lefroy is a Lady Russell figure. She was 20 years older than Jane Austen. She took Jane Austen, the young Jane Austen, under her wing. Then her gorgeous, handsome, sexy nephew comes. And the family tradition is that Mrs. Lefroy advised Tom Lefroy not to go near Jane Austen. So she's very much a Lady Russell figure. This is someone who persuades Tom or Jane that this won't do. And I think that is, there's lots of well-documented anecdotal evidence from the family to suggest that Mrs. Lefroy was a prominent figure in persuading them apart. But she did part them. And he went on to marry somebody else and then became a High Court judge in Ireland and wrote a letter as a very old man in which he said, yes, he had loved Jane Austen, but it was a boy's love.
This story sounds very familiar. A passionate young love. A penniless suitor, a persuasion to part. But of course, there's only so far we can take this. Tom Lefroy didn't come back. Like Captain Wentworth, he got rich, but he married someone else. As an elderly man, Tom Lefroy downplays his feelings for Austin. It was just a boy's love. But how serious was it on Austin's part? Certainly, even 2 years later, we know she's still thinking about him. Because on November the 17th, 1798, she mentions Lefroy in another letter to Cassandra.
Mrs. Lefroy did come last Wednesday, and I was enough alone to hear all that was interesting, which you will easily credit when I tell you that of her nephew she said nothing at all. And I was too proud to make any inquiries. But on my father afterwards asking where he was, I learnt that he was gone back to London, in his way to Ireland, where he is called to the bar and means to practice.
Too proud to ask? That's fascinating. She doesn't want to reveal that she still cares. Lefroy married, Jane didn't. Is she writing in Persuasion the ending she didn't get in real life? If so, then publishing the novel would be a massive exposure of her private life, one she might not have been prepared to risk while still alive. But is this making too much of her relationship with Lefroy? Maybe not. Buried in the first biography of Austin, published by her nephew James Edward Austin Lee in 1871, is evidence that she turned down at least one proposal of marriage as a young woman. Here, Lee writes, in her youth she had declined the addresses of a gentleman who had the recommendations of good character and position in life, of everything, in fact, except the subtle power of touching her heart. Austin turns the proposal down because she doesn't love him. But the crucial question is, when did this happen? If it was after her relationship with Lefroy, it might indicate that her heart still lay with him.
There was a man called Harris Big Wither who actually came to this college, Worcester College. So I had a little scrabble around after Jane Austen dumped him. So she dumped him. So basically what happened was when he was here as an undergraduate, he proposed to Jane Austen in the early 1800s.
So it was after her relationship with Lefroy. What happened?
She was great friends with his sisters and she was staying with the sisters when he proposed. And she said yes. And they were all thrilled because then she would become a beloved sister-in-law. And the next morning she woke up and she couldn't go through with it. So she fled with Cassandra and they fled back to Steventon in tears. And so I had a scrabble around and thought, let me look at his battles. Now, your battles are what drink you buy, what booze you buy when you're in college.
Oh, really?
So I had this lovely idea that maybe Harris Big Wither went on the bottle after he
went on a bender when Jane Austen dumped him.
That was my absolute... I just thought, I'll go see how much brandy, how much sherry did he consume after Jane Austen dumped him? Have to say, when I looked at his battles, no evidence of him going on a bender.
Oh, that's a shame.
Darn it.
So it doesn't seem like Harris Bigwither tried to drown his sorrows. But more seriously, maybe Austen refused him because, like Anne Elliot, her heart still lay with someone else. OK, what do we know so far? Austen sat on the novel after it was finished. And this delay in publication was deliberate. Margaret Drabble thinks that Austen knew she was dying and the novel could be construed as deeply personal. So maybe she was holding it back to ensure that publication was posthumous, to protect herself and maintain her pride. But this can only ever be speculation. We can't know how deeply nor for how long Austen loved Tom Lefroy. And what worries me too is that this explanation is only an emotional one. It buys into the picture of Austen painted by her brother Henry in the memoir he published with Persuasion after her death. I've got it here. So these are the first public words that describe Austen, and for a long time they have shaped public perception of her. He says that she was religious and led a quiet life, that she was retiring with no ambition to fame or fortune. He's at pains to portray her as a lady rather than a writer. I'm really wary of that stereotype, and I wonder what we can learn from looking at Austen the writer rather than Austen the woman. What hard evidence is there in her publishing history that might offer a very different explanation for the delay in publishing Persuasion? I'm in the dining parlour back in Jane Austen's house in Chawton, and I'm looking at a reproduction of a letter from Jane Austen to John Murray, the publisher who was eventually to bring out Persuasion. But Austen didn't start out her career with this eminent publisher. Like most writers, she didn't have an easy time getting published at all. In 1797, her father offered an early version of Pride and Prejudice to Cadell, the most famous publisher of novels at that time. He turned it down by return of post. Then in 1803, an early version of Northanger Abbey gets bought by Crosby for £10, but he doesn't publish it. Finally, in 1811, the military publisher Egerton takes Austen on, and he brings out Sense and Sensibility. Egerton also publishes Pride and Prejudice and Mansfield Park. It's only by 1815 that Austen's finally successful enough to move from an obscure military publisher to John Murray, who's got the likes of Byron on his lists. Now, none of this strikes me as the career history of someone who doesn't care about being published, someone who isn't ambitious for her work to reach a wider public. On the contrary, this evidences absolute determination and tenacity. When I mentioned her second publisher, John Murray, to Catherine Sutherland, she told me a very interesting detail.
Anne Elliot is a name that is shared by a real person, that John Murray, her publisher, his wife was Anne Elliot.
Ah, and Jane had met her in time to, or knew of her in time to possibly use that
We
name.
Have no biographical facts. And I think partly guided by Henry Austin, who presents his sister as this retreating, retiring, shy Violet, we've just assumed that she didn't visit Murray's publishing house. But why not? We have no evidence that she didn't. She's working on Emma at Henry's home in Hans Place in Chelsea, which is just across Green Park from Albemarle Street, where John Murray is. She knows we know she is sending the manuscripts or the proof sheets over to John Murray's to check after she's checked the proof sheets. Why wouldn't she have walked over there herself? We also know she's shopping on Bond Street, which is the next street parallel to Albemarle Street. I find it quite unlikely that she did not visit John Murray in his publishing house in Albemarle Street. We know that John Murray's wife, Anne Elliot, worked closely with him, often copying, recopying manuscript for him. I think it's quite likely that on a social occasion or professional occasion, Jane Austen met Anne Elliot. The name simply perhaps pleased her.
Or I'm being more calculative here, but it would be quite a sensible strategic decision to kind of get the patronage of your publisher by honouring him by including his wife's
remember,
name.
Remember, he's already published a novel of hers, so she's got him.
Yeah.
But I think Jane Austen is playful. John Murray's father, John Murray I, had been a naval officer before he was a publisher.
So the inclusion of the Navy in Persuasion is also persuasive.
John Murray, exactly. John Murray publishes the Navy list that's mentioned as part of Anne Elliot's reading matter. I think there's just a sweet little compliment there.
And the Navy is all over this novel, not
all
just
over
in
the novel.
That there are naval officers.
That's right.
But it's there in the imagery as well, in the language that she
uses. Jane Austen began writing this novel. We know the dates at which she began writing it because they're recorded by Cassandra, her sister. And Jane Austen began the novel on the 8th of August, 1815. The 8th of August is the day on which the English newspapers are recording Napoleon's departure for St. Helena after that decisive defeat at Waterloo. So she's beginning the novel decisively when war is over, Napoleonic wars are finished. But she sets the novel, and she tells us this in the opening chapter, unusually tells us, this present time, she says, the summer of 1814.
Yes.
So she set it 1 year before. Now, 1 year before, her readers, who are reading, of course, in 1817, 1818, know that 1 year before, it seemed like things were over. Napoleon was off on Elba. But, in fact, they weren't over. And that year, 1814 to 15, the year in which the novel is set, but it's written a year later, is called The False Peace. And it's that false peace that has brought Captain Wentworth home from the sea. Very quietly, one doesn't normally think of this as a historical novel, but I think you could expand the definition of historical novel and see this as Jane Austen's domestic contribution to historical novel.
This gives a very different picture of Austen, historically aware, professionally playful, maybe even strategic in her choice of names and topics. I wonder just how ambitious she actually was. I'm going back to the British Library with Catherine Sutherland to see if we can learn anything from the actual material object of those draft chapters of Persuasion.
She wrote the two chapters into a single booklet of 32 pages.
It's very small. It's much smaller than I was expecting.
It is very small.
An iPhone probably is about the right size.
That's quite a good comparison.
Yeah.
But she wrote deliberately into what already appeared to be gatherings, the kind of gatherings that eventually will be stitched together, perhaps 12 of them, to make the volume of a novel. She did enjoy the idea that from the beginning she was creating something that looked like a novel.
Yes.
Not all writers do. She fashioned these herself. She fashioned them by cutting down larger pieces of paper, folding them, making them into tiny booklets.
So she was a kind of artisan.
Yes.
Okay, so Austen composed in these self-made books. This seems to me a clear sign of ambition. She's conceiving of her works not just as stories to read to her family, but as books to be published and read by the world. So is the delay in publishing Persuasion a business decision? Catherine's got something else to show me that fits with this idea of Austin as a determined professional author.
What we're looking at now is a collection of opinions of Mansfield Park.
Opinions, literally, what opinions other people thought about it.
Opinions of her readers of Mansfield Park. Ah. It sold out, but there were no reviews of it. And she wanted to persuade her publishers to bring out a second edition, but there'd been no reviews. So she, I think, this is my view, she began collecting the opinions together.
She compiled her own reviews.
Yes, she did.
Wow.
They're not all utterly flattering, but
yes, but they don't need to be.
A considerable number of them are, and she is getting a range of opinions. So it starts with family and friends, but then it moves out wider. And I think she was using them possibly for two reasons, because she does mention in a letter of November 1814 that she has put down, Mrs. Creed's opinion is down on my list, she says, and there it is. And then a few days later she says, I'm going to see Edgerton about a second edition of Mansfield Park. And I think Edgerton at this time, Thomas Edgerton, was her publisher. I think she was using it for that. But I think also we know that she's possibly using them as well as something that, you know, if Edgerton won't play, I will offer my book and I'll take along these opinions to bolster my confidence. I'll offer it to Murray.
She's doing her own PR, though. She's doing her own marketing, isn't
she? I think she is. I think these lists of opinions, because she hasn't built up a list of opinions for any of her other novels, I think it's a sign of her increasing professionalism as a writer.
Did she make money from her writing?
She did make money, but her lifetime earnings were really quite modest. I mean, in her lifetime, she kept meticulous accounts, so we know that in her lifetime she made £630, which would be approximately £25,000 in today's money.
But that's over a period of eight years?
It's over a period. It's from 1811 to 18, yes, the year she died.
Was she financially well-placed at the time she was writing Persuasion?
Well, no, she wasn't. And I think that could have had significant effect on possibly delaying its publication. Her previous novels, the publication of Emma had been issued in a large edition and it was selling slowly. It was selling quite well at first, but it was selling slowly. But alongside that, there was the rather disastrous second edition of Mansfield Park. And so she wasn't making the money at that point that she expected to make.
And why was that second edition of Mansfield Park disastrous? It just didn't sell.
Well, it's interesting because the first edition sold quickly and it made her biggest lifetime profit. But I think the market was saturated with it. As she herself says, you know, people are more willing to read and to praise than to buy. You have to remember that novels at this time were prohibitively expensive. We're talking about, you know, something like in today's money of £100 for a novel.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, people were just not buying them. They were finding other ways of reading them through lending libraries, borrowing one another's copies and so on. And there just wasn't a market for it.
So what I don't quite understand, there's a financial risk involved in publishing.
Yes.
Is that because she has to put up her own money up front?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, no. She should have known by now that she didn't have to put the money up front, because what happened in her way of publishing, which is publishing on commission, is that the publisher himself takes the risk.
Okay.
So he pays out for paper, for type, for advertising, for distribution, all up front. He then takes a 10% commission on every copy sold, and any profits left when all the costs have been covered go to the author.
Ah, so the risk is not selling enough.
That's right.
To cover those costs, and then she would have been liable for
that. That's right, and then she would have been liable. So all we can say is that her recent experience of Emma and Mansfield Park could have been a bit of a hit there. She has never not broke even and made some money before. But, you know, in this instance, she only had £39 to show for what we would now regard as, you know, one of her greatest novels, which was Emma.
So by 1817, the last year of her life, Austin has a growing reputation as an author, but she isn't in the top league commercially. So was the delay in publishing Persuasion a financial decision? The losses on the second edition of Mansfield Park have eaten into the profits of Emma. If she publishes Persuasion and doesn't sell enough copies, it's not just that she might not make money, she might actually end up in debt to her publisher. But Catherine says that this has actually never happened to her. So there must be something else going on in her life at this point that makes her reluctant to take a financial risk. Back to Paula Byrne.
She lost all her money in Henry's bank, her brother Henry, who was an absolute nightmare. He was, you know, one minute a soldier, one minute a clergyman, one minute a banker. You know, oh, what a Henry, she says in one of the letters. Oh, what a Henry, you know, and what a Henry he was. And he was always on these get-rich-quick schemes. And she lost quite a lot of money.
Henry's bank collapses at the end of 1815. Austin loses her money and the financial support she's been getting from her brother's stops because they had money in the bank too. That had to be catastrophic. Now, Emma, at the end of 1815, is already about to be published, so it isn't affected. But I can see why she couldn't possibly countenance putting another book through publication with all the financial risks involved at this point. But what's changed for her to tell Fanny just over a year later that she can now see it being published? Well, it's probably because 5 days after writing to Fanny, her uncle James Lee Perrott dies. And at the time of writing, she's expecting to be named in his will. She is named, but she only gets the money after his wife dies. This would explain why even after the hopeful letter, she doesn't start publication proceedings for Persuasion before her death. Persuasion is so often read as Austen's final novel. But it wasn't. It was her last completed novel, yes, but she carried on writing after Persuasion, an unfinished novel we now know as Sanderton. How much of it had she written before she died, and how does it fit into our story? I'm going back to Margaret Drabble to find out.
She got to chapter 12 before she died, but not very far into the plot. She'd set up some of her main characters and the situation and the little town of Sanditon, but she hadn't got further into the plot. But there's something very forward-looking about Sanditon, which is odd.
Sanditon is a seaside town that the enterprising Mr. Parker has ploughed a huge amount of money into, speculating that he can turn it into a fashionable resort and make a profit on his investment.
Mr. Parker held it indeed as certain that no person could be really well without spending at least 6 weeks by the sea every year. Nobody could catch cold by the sea, nobody wanted appetite by the sea, nobody wanted spirits. Nobody wanted strength.
She wrote Sanditon almost then immediately after Persuasion, in this interim between the manuscript of Persuasion being finished and her dying. Is it connected to Persuasion? Can you see patterns or themes in Sanditon that are there in the novel she just finished?
Both of the novels are about change. I mean, Persuasion, a lot of Persuasion is about change in the social order. So both of the novels are on the cusp of change, of social change, where you could make a fortune by joining the Navy and making a great prize. So there is a lot about risk. But what she has not done in Sanditon is recoil from risk.
Yeah.
I think some people have read it that it is a recoil from risk and that she hates capitalism and she doesn't approve of the development of Sanditon. But I don't read it like that because... She's watching it all with a keen interest.
Is Austen trying to convince herself with Sanditon to publish Persuasion by writing a tale that embraces financial risk? Or is there actually something else going on here? What Austen wrote of Sanditon promises a novel that was going to be startlingly new in setting, in character and in theme. I wonder what Catherine Sutherland thinks of the connections between Persuasion and Sanditon.
Both novels are about taking risks. Anne didn't take a risk and regrets it, but she knows now is the right time to turn her back on an old world. Captain Wentworth, part of his charm is that he was a sailor and he takes risks every day with his life.
That very last paragraph of Persuasion is about the risks of the future, the tax that Anne may have to pay, the risk she takes for being a sailor's wife.
Do you think Jane Austen herself was taking a risk with Persuasion?
Yes. Perhaps she held back Persuasion. And this is a little fanciful, but she may have held it back for a short while until she had established that new novel, and then she would let Persuasion go.
Was this a pattern you could see in earlier work? Did she often hold one novel back until the next one was kind of underway?
We don't know that it was holding back, but the novels do seem to go in twos. And we do know that there was one already well developed before she sent the previous one off. So Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice work together in that way. Certainly Emma and Mansfield Park are working together in that way. And I think Persuasion and Sanderton are working together in that way too.
So Sanderton is Persuasion's kind of a missing twin.
So this is how Sanderton fits. It gives a creative reason why Austen might have been holding Persuasion back. It was feeding the new novel. And the timings fit. She started Sanderton in January 1817. And remember, she tells Fanny in March 1817 that Persuasion will be published in around 12 months' time. Well, that's how long it usually took her to finish a novel. So she's envisaging that Persuasion will be published around the time she finishes Sanderton. Now, this pairing of novels, as Catherine says, was a pattern in Austen. But you can see why it was even more important to do it here. Because both Persuasion and Sanderton are taking Austen to places she had never gone before.
Jane Austen experimented for me with lots of different kinds of novel writing. She was very pioneering. And I think once she'd done Persuasion, she just turned her mind to something completely different, which is almost a Dickensian book. Sanderton's Dickensian panoramic. It would have changed the shape of the novel. I'm absolutely convinced of it. It's almost George Eliot-like.
Wow, that's a massive claim.
Mm-hmm.
So not just changed the shape of Austen's writing, but changed the history of the novel.
Oh, I think without a doubt, it was moving into a very interesting direction. It feels like these wonderful, satirical, almost grotesque characters. And you sort of feel like that's the beginning of the great Victorian novel.
Wow.
She's a Georgian when she's writing, when she's starting her writing. She's a Georgian. There's a shift, I think, in Sanderton.
So is there a sense in which we think of Persuasion as her last novel, but actually if she hadn't died when she had, we might look back and see it as a kind of mid-career pivotal novel.
That's right,
opening out onto her mature phase.
Yes.
Which paints it in a very different light.
I think she is an ambitious writer. She is ambitious for herself as a writer. She's ambitious for the art of the novel. So she's pushing the novel in new directions too.
I've come back to Jane Austen's house in Chawton, to the very room in which she finished Persuasion. The story behind the posthumous publication of this novel has revealed that at the end of her life, Austen was on the cusp of a literary revolution. In Persuasion, we can see her straining at the seams of her origins as a domestic novelist. With Sanderton, she would have broken free. She was holding Persuasion back because she was about to take her greatest professional risk yet, publishing a pair of books, Persuasion and Sanderton, that would have changed the history of the novel as we know it today. Persuasion may have been Jane Austen's last completed novel, but if she had lived, it would have been just the beginning.